Welcome to the CRA Resource Show. CRA Resources is a unique recruitment agency with a single focus of providing CRA staffing for clinical studies across North America. My name is Becky Clark, and I am Operations Manager at CRA Resources. Today, we're sitting down with Angela Roberts, Head of Recruiting, and special guest Dahlia Tsuroff. Dahlia is a CRA manager who has a lot of experience hiring quality CRA candidates within the clinical research industry. So before we get started, make sure to visit craresources.com/blog to catch up on our latest blog posts. You can also sign up there to get this content delivered to your inbox. So I'll turn it over to Angela and she can give us more details on our topic today.
Well, if anybody has been receiving emails or messages from me this week, then they know my hot topic for 2024 is candidate fraudulence. I am so tired of dealing with candidate fraudulence, especially in the CRA space. It's wasting everybody's time. It's causing big bottlenecks in hiring. It's also causing us to overlook high quality CRAs. And I think if we band together, we can nip it in the bud. So that is my mantra for this year. I've got fraudulence stamped on my forehead. And and it was really cool whenever I messaged Dahlia, she came back to me and, Dahlia, you've experienced this a lot within the last year or so, haven't you? I think the percentage of what you suspected to be fake CRAs was really high. So tell us a little bit about what your experience has been overall in terms of volume of CRA fraudulence as you've gone through the hiring process.
Well, at one of the companies that I've worked at, the percentage of, and we call them questionable CRAs, to be diplomatically correct, but the percentage was close to 70%. And we were concerned whether we would be able to bring enough of quality CRAs within a given time frame. Mm-hmm. And we struggled finding the good CRAs, and you would look through many, many CRAs, and actually the CVs would look just phenomenal. Yeah. And once you get to the interview, that's when, you know, there would be red flags. So yes, I've gone through that, especially within the past year.
Yeah. It's funny because I had a conversation with another company last week and they're looking to actually bring us on board because they've experienced something similar. She quoted 90%, and I don't know her data comes from, but I'm like, bless her heart, because she's a dedicated recruiter. She's one person for a small to medium sized CRO. And I'm thinking to myself, how in the world does a team of, I don't know how many people were on your hiring team, but I would imagine it was no more than four or five, right? So you've got, we've had as many as 700 applicants to one of our CRA jobs. How would a person, one person, or a team of four or five go through 700 resumes to determine who's fake, who's qualified, and out of the qualified, who you speak with? Because it's just overwhelming, isn't it?
It is. And that's why you rely on good recruiters, sort of, mm-hmm. you know, the first step, you know, mm-hmm. pre-screening step. Yeah. You ask them at CVs and you tell them what it is that you're looking for. If a sponsor specifies the therapeutic experience, you look at CV to see whether it's oncology, solid tumors, whether it's listed there, or whether it's liquid tumors, whether it's listed there. Then you're looking at the number of years, because mm-hmm. ideally you would want kind of like, you don't want all of your CRAs to be newbies.
Right.
You mm-hmm. want kind of a combination, 20 to 30%. You want to have new CRAs, meaning that they're monitored for 2 to 3 years. Then you want the bulk of the CRAs to be somewhere beyond the 5-year mark in terms of experience. Mm-hmm. And then like the remaining percentage would be kind of like veterans who've been in the field for many, many years, like mm-hmm. over 10 mm-hmm. plus years. And you know, you look at that. Then you're looking at, you know, their credentials. And of course, one of the things that I ask recruiters to pay attention to is how quickly they jump from one project to another.
Right.
I mean, if it's contract, it's understandable if they have a short-term contract. or even a couple of contracts if they're working part-time on one contract and another one, that's understandable. But if it's a full-time opportunity and then they jump after every year, that's alarming to me. That basically indicates there is no longevity with that candidate. Then you would look for any kind of typos, you know, any kind of tasks that do not align with CRA tasks.
We see that a lot too.
So, and of course, you know, if you've seen that resume before, sometimes we remember, like someone applied and then we already pre-screened them and they apply again and you kind of like flag them in the system. So the first help would be coming from recruiters. And you kind of like train them on what you're looking for. And then once they select the person, that person goes to, you know, into your pile and then you look at their credentials and say, yes, I think that would be a good candidate to interview.
Do you think your recruiter, and I agree with all of that. I love that you went through that detail. And I, the only thing that I would segue is, and dig a little bit further is contract positions. When we're looking at job longevity, because that is a really important thing to us as well. But we ask the question for contracts. Did you end the contract because the contract just ended? Or did you end the contract before it was naturally expected to end? And did you have a chance to renew your assignment? Because if it's a CRO, for example, okay, so one project ended, but if you were doing really well, there are other projects. I mean, did they offer to let you stay? And did you decide not to stay? If so, why didn't you? You know, just kind of starting to understand where their head is whenever it comes to making a decision to stay or go. Because with perms and contracts along, well, I didn't like my manager, or I got a better offer, or I didn't want to travel, and you know, whatever, understanding those reasons are very, very, very helpful. So I think it's really important. Now, let me ask you this, and I love that you leaned on your recruiter, and I love it even more that you gave them direction, because we got clients that don't. They just say, I need five CRAs, and we have to go back and ask them where. What kind of utilization? What is your therapeutics if it's a CRO? You know, what do you need them for? How long of a project? What is the frequency of monitoring? I mean, we got to ask all these questions to know what specifically they're. Yeah, exactly. All this stuff. Yes. They're like, yes. I just need five people. Okay, well, can you help me out a little bit here? But did you also give your recruiters work direction on how to identify fraudulence, or did you expect your recruiters to already do that?
Some of them are very, knowledgeable in that regard. We even had, I'll give an example. We even had a person who applied and we interviewed that person. And then recruiter had a pre-screening call, which was a video call. And then myself and another manager, we had a second interview. And then the person looked one way, and then on LinkedIn, they looked much younger. And then recruiter immediately reached out to me and she said, I don't have a good feeling about it, you know, right off the bat. And that suspicion was confirmed that it was a questionable CRA.
I love that you call it questionable. For the audience that's listening, and here's the thing, and I like to say this too, to those individuals, especially the ones that I've been emailing and that are asking me the questions. We identify fraudulent candidates as fraudulent whenever we've proven fraudulence. But we do have a not now category that maybe that would be more of a questionable category, to where we haven't proven it, but we've got a suspicion. And so as talent acquisition, we don't have to interview them. We can put them into a not now category because, hey, I'm looking for Marilyn Monroe's. They look like a Jacqueline Kennedy. I'm not on talk to them, right? Because I'm looking for Marilyn Monroe's. And so that makes it easier for talent acquisition. But HR is not like that, is it? When you guys, from an HR perspective, you work for the company and you're working through a kind of a formal thing, you had to interview everyone the same amount of time, didn't you? I mean, you had to go through like the whole screening process. And talk to us about that and how that just you. Well, tell us about that first, and then I have a follow-on question.
Well, when I started my career as a CRA manager, I remember, you know, I would be asked to do the interviews for half an hour, you know, and then it quickly became apparent that was not enough time to really know how good of a CRA that applicant is. And quite honestly, I think the good amount of time to interview someone is roughly 45 to 50 minutes, leaving about 10 minutes for any kind of follow-up questions. If they have questions for me in regards to the company, our group, et cetera. So I would think that the best amount of time for interviewing is approximately 1 hour. Some might argue, like, what about like 1 hour and 15 minutes so that you don't have like interviews stacked up against each other. That can be done just, you know, for the calendar to look pretty, you know, and so that you're not rushed, you know, from one interview to another. But realistically, the interview would last for an hour.
Yeah. Well, and you were held accountable. If you had an interview scheduled, you were expected to spend that whole hour with them, weren't you? Regardless.
It's not so much about that. We just did not want for people to be immediately know that something went wrong in an interview. So sometimes like within the 15 minutes, I would know that the candidate is not a good CRA for us. I would continue asking questions, you know, until the interview finished, just because we did not want to, for it to be a negative experience. And then we would treat it as a normal interview. And then we would provide the feedback to the recruiter who would later reach out to them. So not to give out basically, the information and how the interview went. So, but I would not hire this person, but, you know, I would have to sit through until, you know, the very bitter end.
Did that drive you crazy? Because I tell my team, hey, God gives you a gut for a reason. And if your gut is screaming and you know this is not a candidate we're going to represent, you abort, 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 run away, stop the interview, go on and do something else, right? So, but again, I mean, we're talent acquisition. I think we have a little more freedom there. And from an HR perspective, I know when I work with IBM as a hiring manager, we were expected to ask every question on that screening form, because if anybody ever ended up suing you for not selecting them due to discrimination or whatever reason they would come up with, then you had this capability of saying, no, here's the answers and this is how it compared and this is why I decided not to move forward with this candidate versus another. But Lordy mercy at the amount of time it takes to do that.
Agreed.
And Dahlia, I'm really interested in knowing what happens during the interview that makes you be suspicious, or what are some red flags that you've seen? Can you give us some examples of things that would make you think right in the beginning or as you're going through the interview, at that step of the process, what might be a red flag?
Absolutely. So there were different kind of scenarios, you know, that I would pay attention to. Obviously, with questionable CRAs, they would be big red flags. Like, for example, they would be wearing a headset, but then, the volume that will be coming through, it would sound as if they were speaking through the computer. And I've actually had an instance like that where I asked, you know, point blank, I asked, are you talking through your headset or, you know, are you talking through computer speakers? And she said, I'm talking through computer. And at that point, I said, well, in that case, would you mind taking off the headset? And then from that point, the interview went south, you know. So that would be like one red flag. Then also, some of the people would wear wigs, you know, and those are extreme cases, you know. And I think to hide the fact that they would have, some kind of like headphones or someone speaking to them, and to hide that fact. So that was going on as well. And then
never heard of anybody wearing a wig in an interview that you could tell maybe they were hiding a headset. I mean, you know, wear a wig if you need to wear a wig. But I mean, having a headset in underneath the wig is kind of a little, I mean, that's insane what people go to do, right?
Yeah, because some interviews are video. I mean, yeah. I didn't even ask you that, Dahlia. Are your interviews, I mean, do you find it's mostly video or audio only, or what format are we talking about?
No, all of the interviews were videos. Interviews.
That's helpful. Simply,
yeah, because it's really hard to gauge what's happening on the other end if you're doing it only through a phone. There would be instances also, I refer to them as Milli Vanilli cases, where a person would be talking, but it would not be them talking, but someone else. And there would always be kind of like a delay And, you know, but then you would look intensely at their, you know, lips and you would see the discrepancies, you know, even with a delay of 3-4 seconds, you would see that what they're saying is different from what the person is saying for them. So that was very interesting. And those were, I hate to say it, but those were the most entertaining interviews.
Of course.
Lord. Well, you might as well laugh. That's insane, though, isn't it? And you know, we do, we really don't do phone interviews anymore either. I mean, unless it's someone that we know. I mean, if it's someone that we placed a kajillion times, I'll pick up the phone and call them and talk to them because I know them, right? I mean, but you know, video interviews are really the right way to go. And we take snips of the video while we're talking to them. And we compare it to their LinkedIn. Some clients even ask for a copy of their government issue ID, like driver's license or whatever. And so when we submit that resume, we're submitting their government issue ID, the snip of their video. And then of course, you know, if they don't have their LinkedIn profile with the picture, we advise them to put their picture up, because interview fraudulence is just, I mean, it's becoming worse, isn't it, Dahlia? I mean, over and over again, you see where they're getting really creative about how to sidestep the whole video interviewing aspect.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. But I think if you were paying attention to the red flags, and also, you know, if you ask more specific questions, not just generic questions, what mm-hmm. do you do during your monitoring visit? Because you can be easily coached and asked that question. The question needs to be, they need to be more specific and maybe therapeutically aligned, you know, mm-hmm. so that you get a better answer. And even when people give me a really short response, mm-hmm. then in order to understand whether they truly have the knowledge on a particular topic, I ask follow-up questions. I would say, you said this, would you please elaborate when you've seen an instance of this? Mm-hmm. Like, for example, one question would be, have you ever had issues with personally identifiable information, you know, and I was taught to call it PII, but it's actually pronounced as PI. So I would say, have you ever had instances where personal identifiable information was disclosed by a site, and how did you deal with it? You know, mm-hmm. Or can you give me an example, you know, when the ICF was not obtained in the right way, and what did you do about it? You know, what were your steps? You know, what were your follow-up steps with the site? So you have to become more granular mm-hmm. with the candidate. And even like when they give you an answer, you know, drawing on that answer, you know, basically form your next question for them.
Right. I agree. And it becomes more of a conversation about their scenarios. And we do a lot of that too, digging in. It's important because you and I talked about this whenever we had our first brainstorming discussion, but there are entities out there that for a fee, they have these classes. They're like 6-week, 8-week long classes to where these individuals who want to get a CRA gig that have never monitored or never worked in the clinical research industry at all will actually pay this fee to be taught how to pass these interviews. So you ask the basic, you know, what site management, tell me what essential documents are, you start asking all these questions. They know the answer because they've been coached. So right. It's only when you can start digging into the actual, you know, tell me about the endpoints of this oncology project and what were some of the challenges that you saw with SAEs and how did you you know, those are where you really can start identifying the true competency and knowledge of the individual.
Agreed. And you have to get creative with questions, and also you have to switch up the questions. Because
thank you for saying that. Yes.
Yeah, because there are people who apply and then they work in groups. One person goes through, records the questions that you're asking them, and then passes them on to the next question. Yep. So you modify, you tweak the questions a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. or you rotate them. Like, for example, you have 50 questions and, you know, you change them up, you know. You can even ask a very basic question and just see how they respond. You can say, well, how do you address queries, you know? Please tell me, like, what is your approach? You know, like, for example, your site has 120 queries. What would you prioritize? You know, how would you follow up with the site to make sure all of them are addressed? You know, which ones would you tackle first? You know, so you can kind of like change them up and keep the applicants on their toes.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And you're right. I've seen questions on the internet for certain companies. You can Google it. The other thing I like to do too is, like, let's say, for example, they work at PPD. I'm just throwing a company name out there. They say that they work for PPD. They've been there for 6 years. I like to ask questions. Oh, yeah, I know PPD. We've worked with them before. Tell me who was your operations manager? Mm-hmm. And if it's video and you already suspect it's fraudulence, I mean, you're going to see the deer in the headlights where they're trying to come up. Okay, my Aunt Carolyn's name. Can I use Becky's name? Can I use whatever? What if she knows this person? I mean, you can do things like that as well, just to kind of catch them a little bit off guard, especially if there's a little bit of a suspicion, you know, makes a big difference.
Pointed mm-hmm. questions. Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. We do that too in our reference checking. You know, you have to make sure. There's so much that, you know, can slip through. And I think it's so great, Dahlia, that you ask all of those questions and you have mm-hmm. processes in place to try to weed them out. And you told us that once you started doing that, your number dropped significantly of applicants coming. Was that right?
Of fraudulent or questionable.
Questionable applicants. Thank you for that qualification. Yeah.
We would get more, tougher, you know, we would pay attention to every single detail in order not to let people through, because we had a couple of instances where everything looked perfect. They interviewed, you know, and did fantastic job during the interview. But when it came to the background check, then there would be big surprises. And mm-hmm. then myself, and another manager would be scratching our heads and saying, you know, how did we miss that? You know, but then we became kind of more vigilant, I would say, you know, vigilant, paying attention to every single detail, you know. Mm-hmm. We would go as far as our recruiters would actually check the companies. Like, for example, if there is a company that's listed on CV and they've never heard of it, and they would say, oh, it's a small company, Sierra, that just started up in US, they would actually start Googling it, you know, and then we found a lot of, questionable candidates that way. And we would actually have two or three people where, like, one person would be listed as a supervisor or lead CRA for that person, and then they work for the same company that does not actually exist, you know. Mm-hmm. So that would help out a lot, you know, and we would also look at the references, you know, who is their reference? Is it someone that we interviewed before, or have we screened them out because, you know, because they were questionable? Yep. So it was a rather robust process, I would say.
Yeah, ours is very similar in the history, but it takes time, doesn't it? But we do that too. Okay. We keep a listing. We call it the client listing. Every sponsor and CRO that we're aware of, we keep track of when they were founded. If they still are in existence, great. If they are deceased or they've been acquired or they've rebranded or whatever, what those dates were. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you'll have these candidates that'll come through and they will have worked for three different companies that are deceased now. So there's no way that you're going to do an employment verification on these people. Or they'll say that they worked for a company before it existed or before it started doing studies or after it was deceased. Or we actually had a guy yesterday that applied that said he worked for Quintiles in 2019. Quintiles was IQVIA in 2019, and his Rocket Reach and Signal Hire email addresses were Quintiles email address. There's no way there was a Quintiles email address at that time period. Wow. Right. So being able to really, you know, find those minutiae, because these guys are slick and they work together. Like you said, I mean, people for hire for interviews, people are hire for references. I had one client that told me that one of their lead CRAs was approached. Maybe you told me this, but one of their lead CRAs was approached and offered money to be supervisor references for a handful of these fake CRAs that are going through a course right now.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So she was going to be paid to be their supervisor references.
That is crazy.
It's your reputation on the line, you know.
I know.
You want to get that money, you know, because you ruin your reputation, you know. So
I know. I agree.
Yeah. That's amazing. There are so many things out there. This is such a useful conversation. Dahlia, your experience has been so helpful, and I really mm-hmm. want it to be encouraging for the other hiring managers out there. There are things to do to protect yourself from this kind of fraudulence or questionable quality. We really want to make sure you're protected and you have these things in place. And we're certainly here to help you as well if you need that. We are happy to do that. Dahlia, thank you. This has been so great. I'm so sorry we're out of time. I just want to keep picking your brain. So please come back and talk with us again. Sure. So thank you, Angela. Thank you, Dahlia, for joining us today. Thanks to everybody out there listening. At CRA Resources, we understand you have many options when it comes to selecting which clinical recruiting company to partner with. Not only do we take pride in working with the highest quality CRAs and site managers, we also only work with quality pharmas, biotechs, medical device companies, and CROs who recognize the importance and value of a CRA's role. So feel free to reach out at CRAresources.com for more information about our firm. We cannot wait to work with you.